Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Josh Brown, my friend, this is one of the last times we will be winding up for the year. We're going to be pre-recording a bunch of stuff, but you're done for Christmas very, very soon, aren't you?
Don't remind me, man. That's like so crazy. Like, this is my last full week, more or less. You know, I've got four days. I've got a half day on Friday, a half day on Monday, and that's me done until after Christmas. I'm incredibly lucky. Cannot wait.
Got a date with the chief. I'm gonna miss you too. Got a massive date with the chief. I hear that the chief is arriving on Wednesday, unless you manage to tickle his ivories at midnight on the Tuesday night. Christmas is just kicking off left, right, and centre. So we're gonna do a couple of pre-records for next week. We might be able to squeeze one in the week after that. I don't know. We're gonna see how we go. But we do have the wind up for this week, the show where we sort of tackle whatever the latest stories are in the gaming industry, whatever the latest games are, whatever we also just want to talk about. Sometimes there's something that just needs to be talked about. For this week, we thought we'd talk about the Sony Spartacus service, which is a hilarious name for their apparent answer to Game Pass. That's got leaked by Bloomberg and by Mr. Jason Schreier, because who else, to be honest, if it's not him, if it's not the farmer, it's got to be Jason Schreier. So so this got leaked. Apparently Sony are working on something to drop across 2022, and at the minute it's codenamed Spartacus. It is meant to be their answer to Xbox's Game Pass, and it's said that higher tiers of the service, assumedly it would be a monthly subscription thing, higher tiers would include PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3 and PlayStation Portable games, as Sony will move to phase out PlayStation Now. What was your immediate reaction to this before we pick some bits of it apart?
My immediate reaction was, I can't believe this has dropped at 6:30 on a Friday when we're not at work anymore and we can't cover it, because that's how all news works, apparently. But my immediate reaction after that was just kind of excitement, because I've wanted Sony to do this for a long, long time, and it feels like they're definitely playing catch up. But I'm pleased they're not just kind of sticking to their guns for no reason, to push on with PS Now as it is now, and to not take the competition directly to Microsoft, because Game Pass is so good. Game Pass is a great system, and I love it, man. Like, it's really excelled the Xbox Series X as a console. I'm really enjoying it, and I quite like PS Now, but it just can't compete. Like, the streaming part of PS Now especially, I hope that's phased out. I want things to be fully downloadable if we do go into the service. But yeah, the fact that I think it was spring 2022 was the proposed launch date for it. Like, I want them to get this out as soon as possible, but I'm more want them to get it right.
The thing is, for me, it feels like they're sort of looking at what Nintendo do, because like on Xbox side of things, obviously they're, you know, it's Jason's report and everything, but he is mentioning the higher tier stuff, PS1, PS2, old school games. For the most part, Xbox keep those things separate. Like, occasionally you'll get like an older game as like part of Game Pass, but they're usually their backwards compatible stuff as a separate wing of the company for the most part, or the separate wing of the marketing than something that gets included in Game Pass. And I also kind of wonder like how much that's Xbox just going like, well, you know, we only have so many titles that we can sort of lean on, like the likes of the Fable series is available on backwards compat, but they've remade Gears of War, they've remade Halo, and it's one of those things where like I would like Xbox to have more confidence in their history and like pick up random things like you know, Mad Dash Racing or whatever you need to get your hands on, to say like, this is Xbox, we have a history, we're going to give you this monthly service with everything on it. But in Sony's case, obviously they have that legacy writ large, and they can literally go, I mean, we covered this, it's been many years of like different rumors surrounding this kind of thing. We talked about this in the run up to the PlayStation 5. There was a rumor doing the rounds a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, that Sony were planning this system that would, it was something Mark Cerny said about, it was like a capable of playing or emulating these old systems, and I wonder in regards to them then, you know, applying that to a monthly model, whether they do like, you know, it's PlayStation 1 month and then it's, oh, it's PlayStation 2 months coming in a couple of months, or they do like franchise based, or whether they literally just give you an archive of the entire PlayStation, of everything PlayStation, for some crazy premium fee. Yeah. And then just go from there. Because it seems like Sony love to look at the competition and go, well, what can we do that's a mix of what they're doing? And I wonder if they just combine Game Pass with Switch Online. Because Nintendo's thing is, here's Mario 64, here's Mario Tennis. Yeah. We don't have anything new that we want to give you as part of this monthly thing. So here's the old stuff.
Well, this is like my headcanon, of course, but I like the idea.
I will also
Mark
say,
says,
sorry, that I completely inhaled a flapjack before doing this podcast, and I'm very much on a sugar high. Yeah. I've got a coffee right now. It's just, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but carry on.
That's the best way to do it, man. I had a Greg's festive bake, and now I think I'm done for the day. Like, that's
it wasn't that festive,
completely.
Was it? You had one of them, and it didn't seem to lift your spirits.
It was cold. My lovely girlfriend went out to Greg's on her day off to get me a festive bake, and unfortunately, was cold. Bless her heart. What were we saying? Oh, yes. In my headcanon, I like to think Mark Cerny was at least, you know, all for like the backwards compat thing. But obviously, your friend and mine, Jim Ryan, was out there being like, here, man. Nobody wants to play old games.
Nobody wants to play the original Gran Turismo. What do you mean it's on a monthly service? Right then, fine. I'll get over here then, shall I?
Oh, exactly. He was doing all that. And then obviously now I think the success of Game Pass has just made it so clear that it is viable and people do want to play those old games. Because similar to you, one of the biggest disappointments I always have is when Xbox announces more backwards compatible games and I get all excited and then realize they're not coming to Game Pass as well. Because if they put all of those games on Game Pass, that would be sick. You know, if they put Max Payne 3 on Game Pass, if they put the other Max Payne games on Game Pass, you know, all of the other games that they've announced for backwards compat, I think like they need to merge those worlds a little bit more. And I hope this Spartacus service does that. Because like you said, Sony has this vast library of titles that they're just sitting on, not doing anything with. Like, you can get some overpriced ports like the Ninja Gaiden collection or the Ultimate Alliance collection and stuff, but those things should be more accessible inside a service like this, at least
in my
opinion.
The thing is, like, I wonder how much, because the whole thing with, like you just mentioned, like, you know, the Xbox went out there and secured a whole bunch of different games from Lego Lord of the Rings to Manhunt to Advent Rising and whatever, but not all of them are available on digital, and the likes of Lego Lord of the Rings, you need to go out and get an actual physical disc. They're not selling you the version of it through the digital store. That was like a weird wrinkle to some of these things, because the deals that they've had to go back and do with all these individual publishers mean that they are saying, okay, you can sell the game again. We've renegotiated the songs or whatever it is. But for whatever reason in those original contracts, they can't put them on the digital store. But their whole approach, like, I mean, I have to imagine if you're a publisher sitting, knowing that this is the future of games, then all these individual deals all need to be drawn up again. And someone like Square Enix or, you know, Ubisoft, Activision, whoever it is, are going to start wanting more money for these things, because all those individual games that you can buy on the Xbox store come with a premium price tag, or not necessarily premium in regards to a 60 pounds or 50 pounds, but they're about 15 quid, and it's like, these games are old. Like, I mean, it's not they're not worth £15 overall, but if there's any inbuilt assumption that the price has gone down over time, it hasn't. They're not just on there for £2-3. These are deals renegotiated with publishers, and they are saying, okay, we'll do this, but you are going to pay a lot of money, or, you know, a decent amount of money to get this. I'm saying this as someone who has put about £100 into the recent amount of backwards compatible stuff, because I just want everything. I want the Max Payne games, I want Manhunt, I want Advent Rising, I want all of it.
And why wouldn't you, man? I think that's like incredible. I'm really fascinated by the economics of a system like Game Pass and backwards compatibility, kind of like what you touched on there. You know, we don't know right now how profitable necessarily Game Pass is. We know it's been successful in terms of getting a lot of subscribers. I think there's like just near 20 million subscribers right now, which is pretty good. That's just growing and going to continue to grow. But we don't know things like how much a developer gets paid to put their game immediately on Game Pass, for instance. I think Outriders was one of the games that went straight to Game Pass at launch. And for me, I kind of need to know more about that side of things. I'm kind of going off on a tangent at the moment. Because, you know, you take something like Spotify. Spotify is a service that I pay for and I use every single day, hours upon hours upon hours. But like, the truth is, like, Spotify doesn't pay very well for its streams, and it's not really financially viable for a lot of artists, especially, you know, smaller artists, to get paid by that service. And I just need to know what the model is for kind of the equivalent of you know, smaller developers, indie developers, how much are they getting paid? Is it a good deal? In stuff like that. So there's a lot of stuff to consider on that side of things.
But that brings my point back in as well, because the reason the reason that Spotify's numbers are so terrible is largely because of the music industry as it is. Like, a lot of those individual record labels are charged, will want a ludicrous amount of money. And I kind of wonder if that's also the way that the gaming side of things goes too. And also, it is quite telling that, like, part of the report did focus on ostensibly backwards compatible stuff, but merge the line with a monthly subscription service, because that is a way more of a Nintendo model. That's not what Game Pass is. Game Pass is, a monthly model that gives you premium new releases as part of a monthly model, I guess that's just a sheer curiosity thing, whether that is what Sony want to explore, and whether something is coming to Game Pass day one and also coming to Spartacus day one, or whether they are literally, because the way the report rolls out, saying that, you know, they want to find a way to offer you, the legacy of PlayStation for a monthly fee, and whether that'll be something that they then say, oh, well, Tekken 3 is coming in November or whatever, and that's the thing that they rotate through.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at PS Now, they've done pretty well to amass a pretty good collection of PlayStation 4 games, especially, and PlayStation 3 games. But obviously, when you go further back than that, it's a little bit hit or miss. The experiences aren't all that great. Yeah, totally. And I do want them to kind of bridge the gap between the Game Pass model and, I guess, the Nintendo model, to do something that benefits everyone, for people who want to buy into a subscription to get newer games more reliably without having to invest, £70 into something. And I think the report said that PS5 games would come eventually, but they're not going to do the Game Pass thing of having, The Last of Us 3 on day one, because that would go entirely against their £70 you will pay for this model. But, until that point, having a consistent stream of new third-party releases alongside backwards compatible PS2 releases or whatever, they could build a good system. They've tried it before with PS Now. They've tried it before with, remember that the PS4 collection that came with the PlayStation 5?
Oh yes,
which is the PlayStation good, collection, but yeah, could have been expanded upon. Could have being more than it was, I just hope if they do it, they whole ass it and don't just half ass it.
That thing about that, I forgot they made that whole statement about, we think that PlayStation 5 games are worth £70, and then the average consumer has went, well, we don't, we'll give it a few months until the edge gets taken off. And obviously some stuff has still succeeded despite that, the likes of Spider-Man or whatever, but the likes of Returnal had a very slow uptake on its sales. And I think it took a long time before that sort of settled in. And something like this, if they do chase the Game Pass model, i.e., any first-party PlayStation exclusive is on Spartacus for, 2 weeks or a month or forever. Xbox's approach is just everything is on there regardless. And it's interesting just to throw one quick thing in that you said about, is it actually profitable? The word that Phil Spencer has used is sustainable. I think when he was pushed, he said it was profitable. But he said it was always down to individual deals that have been made. And someone like Rockstar, I remember when they put Red Dead Redemption 2 on Game Pass, I'm sure it was only on there for 2 weeks. It was maybe a month. But that felt like them sort of putting it on, we'll test the waters, we'll see what this is like. And then Xbox getting to benefit from, Red Dead Redemption 2 or, GTA 5 or whatever is on Game Pass. And then immediately it's taken off again because those profit margins either aren't big enough per publisher or they're just not big enough overall. But it is one of those things to just sort of meet out in terms of if you're advertising yourself as a premium service, what even is a first party exclusive? If it is tied to a monthly service.
I think, financially, Sony, but especially the PlayStation division right now, is probably in the best position to launch a service like this, because they made a lot of money, and at this point in time they can afford to take a loss in a subscription, at least at launch, before all of the subscribers get in. It's not like 8 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever, when it felt like PlayStation was fighting tooth and nail to keep the entire company afloat. They have money, they have resources to throw around, so why not start building that now? We're at the start of a new generation. If you can get people to want to buy a PlayStation 5, not just for the games, but for the service, cool.
I think for me, it's I'm very curious on where we are now. It's you have a lot of classic PlayStation games. My mind goes to the Tony Hawk. So Activision took that and they were like, we'd rather remake this than put the original games out as a port. And like I said, that's going to be on Sony to go back to all those individual publishers, negotiate deals, talk about the potential of remakes. Would you guys rather remake it? And maybe they already have something in motion and negotiate all that stuff. And there's a really illuminating interview with, and I forget the name of the guy, but it's the head of the backwards compatibility division over from Xbox, talking on Nextlander, which is the sort of spin-off venture that came from Giant Bomb. It's some of the three main presenters right. that used to be on Giant Bomb doing their own thing. And the way that dude lays out the reality of what they go through for each individual title, it's ludicrous. Like the amount of playtesting they have to do, and they pay for all of it. Xbox saw all of it out because the publishers aren't going to want to pay for, you know, reigniting all their ancient servers or whatever it is, and making sure that all these games work. They have to playtest everything. They have to negotiate the monetary side of it. They have to relicense all the different songs or whatever it is, whatever parts of music. They have to look at all those original contracts. It's a Herculean effort to put it all together. Like, it genuinely feels ludicrous as an undertaking. And part of me doesn't feel like Sony would do that. I feel like, you know, they would do this deal for their first party stuff because they don't have to worry too much about it. But I think when it comes to going wider and getting older PlayStation games like the Resident Evils or Final Fantasies, they either wouldn't do the work or, you know, those publishers would just say, oh, so people care about this, do they? All right, cool. We'll put that out and we'll charge money for it.
Listen, I'm a fan of the PS5. I'm a fan of Sony's first-party games. You know, love all of that stuff.
Couldn't get enough of PlayStation TV.
This is what I'm going to segue into, Scott, my friend. But when it comes to Sony and their services and their kind of peripherals and the things that don't drive the company's profits, they just forget about them. Like PlayStation yes. TV, forgotten about. The PlayStation Vita, forgotten about. You know,
ray tracing, largely forgotten about. Yeah.
Hey, pack that in. Ray tracing, good. One good thing they did.
But it's a good thing, but in terms of a thing that they really put lots of stock into, it is gone. It was a thing at launch, and that's it.
It might come back. Who knows? The point is, though, you're right. They have all of this stuff where they kind of like throw it out there. And they're like, do you want it? And people go, why should we want it? And they go, I don't know. I'm not going to do any work. I'm not going to do anything to make you want it. It's just there. You can have it if you want. And I just hope they don't take that approach to this. They've definitely tried more than they usually do with PlayStation Now. You know, they reinvented it. They offered PlayStation 5 games. They added in downloads. Obviously, that wasn't enough. So I just hope they take the lessons from that service. And like I said, just commit to something long term and don't just abandon it when it doesn't instantly make money.
My gut says that this is them ostensibly doing a Nintendo. I said to you before we started recording that Nintendo, they don't care. Like, they'll put whatever lovable properties they have out over and over and over again. Mario 64 got a release twice in the same half a year. Like, there was one version in the All-Stars collection, then there was another one as part of the Nintendo Switch Online service. And I think they look at that and go, oh, so we can do this. We can take our old titles and we can just put them out again multiple times, and it will just work, quote unquote, because people love these games just that much. Like, you can sort of double dip on them. You can make them available in multiple ways. It makes me very curious. I think at the minute it sounds more like a backwards compatibility monthly service, which I would pay for. I pay for that stupid Switch Online thing. loving Mario Tennis, to be honest, game of the year 2021. But other than that, it's not worth the money at all. And I kind of wonder if that is more the thing that they're chasing. Because if they double down on this in the Game Pass sense, then the idea of a premium new release almost goes away. Because what even is that at this point? Even exclusives would be part of a monthly service. And for me, this is a separate point too, but I am forever curious what completion stats are for Game Pass users. I put it that the only thing I have in regards to data is putting a tweet out, and it was 3/4 of people didn't finish the games that they tried on Game Pass, but obviously they were thankful to be able to try as many games as possible. But my go-to is that if you don't spend money on something, especially in a game, a premium price point, you're not incentivized to finish it. And I wonder how much that also has a knock-on effect on changing the industry, changing the way that games are designed, stories are told, everything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to comment on this, because it's funny, Scott. When I first started doing this job, right, I made a pledge. I was like, I'm going to remember exactly what it was like to not have a job and try to like be into video games and not be able to buy all the video games, and how that would affect me and stuff.
Yeah,
it is, and I've tried to hold on to that, but I guess the reality is, at this point, you know, when we're lucky enough to have this job, we're lucky enough to get free games. Truthfully, that kind of value thing kind of like goes out the window. You know, I download a lot of games and I don't necessarily treat them different to ones that I've bought, you know, in terms of one that we've gotten free or ones that I've gotten on Xbox and stuff. But yeah, I do think you're right. You know, to a lot of players, it's going to be a kind of value thing of, well, I've bought this game, I've spent a lot of money on it, you know, I'm going to want to rinse it dry, whereas opposed to Game Pass, when you can just like try everything and then you're not, there's no commitment there. You know, you can just bounce straight off if you don't want to. And that has its pros and cons, because I think then at the same time, you get people who try things. And if, even if they put four games down out of five they downloaded, that one that they stick to might be something they would have never bought in the first place. I've certainly had that experience before where I might not have bought this game full price, but it was there. I thought the cover looked cool. I've downloaded it. Suddenly it's my game of the year or whatever. Maybe not that far, but you know what I mean? That, you know, pros and cons.
Yeah, that's one of the best positives, or most like standout positives, is that it gets these games in front of people in a way that, that a price point, you know, would have made them not bother. Something like Unpacking is a perfect Game Pass game, and it's a very nice little story, and it works very well as something you can just dip into. But yeah, I think that this, I think it's an interesting thing going forward. For me, it spirals off into a million different talking points or thought processes in regards to how it changes the way games are made, the way stories are told, the way games front load their best moments, the reality of the publishing whim side of it, where it's like, well, just make sure the first half is sorted and people are only going to play that anyway, so it doesn't necessarily matter. The way something like Recore came out, where the whole back half of it was barely rendered because they only finished the first half, and it's like, well, we can just prioritize that because, you know, people aren't going to get there anyway. I'm curious about all that stuff, and I think it is very interesting Sony sort of planting the seeds for it inadvertently, because obviously the story was leaked, but I guess we'll see how it rolls out. In regards to other stuff going on though, the newest BioShock has now had more details from Mr. Colin Murray over on Sacred Symbols. Now, this was something that he talked about a few weeks ago. He said he was he knew it was coming together. He was talking to some of his developer friends, and he said he would follow up when he knew more about it. So he's done exactly that, detailing some stuff. That is a follow-up to last week's news video. We did a little video over on the YouTube channel, and the audio should be somewhere on this feed at some point too. But he said that, as far as he knows, and this is backed up by VGC as well, that the next BioShock is set in a 1960s fictional Antarctic city called Borealis, or whatever you call it. The name of the thing in the space. I've had a flapjack. You know the thing that moves around?
It's all you're green, right, yeah. Easy.
That thing. It's a Borealis. Not an Aurora Borealis, but a Borealis. This is apparently also linked to older BioShock games, but there's nothing any more specific than that. He does note that the team overall are very locked down. Information on the project is very, very thin, but they are targeting a 2022 release day. And to bring wider information in, this does tie in with the Game Awards and Jeff Keighley saying that he's gearing up to announce something that's been in development for 2.5 years. We said this on the news video, but that does line up with when Cloud Chamber were formed, which are the new developer putting this together. Last thing to mention is that Cloud Chamber are made up of old BioShock veterans from 1, 2, and Infinite itself, including Jonathan Pelling, who I looked up as the design director for BioShock Infinite. And there's the original level designer, Hoagie Delaplante, which is a phenomenal name, and art director of BioShock 1 and Infinite, Scott Sinclair. So all them are part of Cloud Chamber. So it seems like there's more veteran staff there, more of that old school feel than you think. The other thing that Moriarty mentioned is that 2K are also publishing Ken Levine's new game. He was obviously the original creative director, the original mastermind of One and Infinite, and Moriarty says that the team are very much aware that they are being directly compared to whatever Ken Levine does next, and the fact that 2K are publishing both those games is kind of tragically hilarious. But what do you think of all this?
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love.
But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
A lot of fascinating information there. The thing that made me swoon a little bit is the fact that it's coming out in 2022. That seems sooner than I expected. Like, considering we've seen nothing from it at the time of this recording, maybe we get something at the Game Awards. You know, we've only had a basic press release announcing the game. That seems incredibly soon, but, you know, if it's ready to go, it's ready to go. I like the idea of it running alongside, you know, concurrently with, I think, you know, I'm pretty sure, like, it's like the Rapture at that same time and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to see how it ties in.
Oh, yeah.
Part of me thinks, though, like, we talk about this every single time we bring up Bioshock because you just can't get past it. You know, Bioshock Infinite kind of blew the entire formula of the series up. You know, there's always a dude, there's always a lighthouse, there's infinite, literally infinite possibilities when always it comes to stories. Mm-hmm. So part of me kind of thinks, like, if you're going to do something, just go with that. Don't have it all linked. Just be like, here's a version of that.
Oh, that's completely different.
That's completely different. He's a version of it. We're just going to go with it because you can still do interesting stories within that framework. Like, not everything in the series has to be connected or a big meta, you know, dissection of narratives in games and stuff. You can just have a good story, and that's sometimes enough. But obviously, I'll wait to see some official things from it. What's about?
That's curious is that obviously Bioshock 1, you know, for a lot of people's favorite of the trilogy, like 2, like kind of like the overlooked, like, you know, your mate who likes Bioshock is always saying, go play 2, you probably should. And then Infinite was like a weird mixed
bag.
That's
Jules, isn't it?
That is Jules. Largely Jules, although I think he likes 2. I forget which one he hates. But then Infinite is the one that was sort of a bit of a mixed bag, looks gorgeous, but it was a bit all over the place. And the ending, like you said, it brings in this whole infinite, like, you know, acknowledgement of what I took to be Ken Levine just saying, like, well, this is my last one. My publisher is very much going to take and run with this, so this is my comment on this can go on forever, but this is the main thing, and I feel like you said, it's like it does set up an infinite number of sequels, but it's always that thing where the original Bioshock, the original Rapture, was always the go-to, either it's iconography or it's the original setting that people like the most, because Bioshock Infinite then got all the I forget what it's called, Under the Sea DLC, and there's a whole bunch of DLC where you return to Rapture.
Yes.
You get to see you know, various states of Rapture after the events of the first game. I think it's after. Anyway, either way, you return to Rapture. And I wonder, like you said, of setting something in the 60s and it's an Antarctic city, it's Borealis, but it is connected to the old Bioshocks. Does Rapture just make another return? Because that's an easy thing to tap back into. Like, is that just something that is Rapture Bioshock, basically? Or can we actually break free of it altogether? Is there always going to be something that takes you back to Rapture over and over and over again?
I hope not. I love Rapture as much as anyone else, but we've had 2 games there, and like you said, we've had the DLC, and the DLC especially rounded off that story so nicely for me and connected it to Infinite way more explicitly than it was in the main game. And I'm like, that's awesome. I will take more games set in that area, that environment, that world. It's so rich. There are so many good characters there. But at the same time, if we've waited this long for a new Bioshock game, like, I just want to see them do something new. I want to this franchise to be about reinvention, about imagination, about creativity. I don't want it to become another series that's just doing what it's known for, because people really like Rapture, but that's safe. And this series has never really been safe.
No, I mean, I think that's the thing, but it wasn't safe because of Levine. Like, obviously, 2 was like a weird sort of addendum to 1, and like, obviously, 2's DLC people talk about quite a lot. But then when he came back in Infinite, it was like you could tell that it had a level of narrative weight or a level of narrative experimentation that wasn't there in 2, just because you do have that auteur at the head of it. And I wonder what it's been like, the literal development process of making another Bioshock with the veteran teams or the team members who were there at the time, but without the guy that they were going, like, is this right? Is this what you want? Is this the right thing? Like, they don't have their Kojima, they don't have their Levine anymore, and that's a very curious thing. But yeah, I mean, we can pivot into the Game Awards stuff, because like I said, Keighley is teasing a huge reveal, and he's been tweeting his ass off left, right, and center, every single little tweet. Do you know the Game Awards is coming? I've got the Game Awards coming. Hey, by the way, Game Awards coming, left, right, and center. So I wanted to like pivot a bit into this and use it as a way to talk about the way the Game Awards gets talked about in the wider discussion amongst gaming. Because do you think that the Game Awards has a problem with being more about the reveals than the Game Awards and the celebration of the gaming industry as a set of talent overall? I don't personally necessarily think that. I'm just broaching it as a wider question. I do see this come up every year, though, that Keighley is sort of slowly turning the Game Awards into E3, and it's less about actually celebrating the artists, the coders, the different teams that brought these games together, which you could argue is what a Game Awards show should be.
That's a fascinating question, that Scott Gelman. I wasn't expecting that when we booted up the old podcast suite today, but it's a great
winding
question.
Up.
And one that I do have some opinions about. You know, when it comes to the Game Awards, especially when, you know, years ago when it was just getting started and like I was just a mere fan of it. It was definitely
before we had old Jeff in the DMs, before we had big yeah. big Jeff going, hey, do you want to vote on stuff? And we're like, yeah, mate, yeah.
It's because it's exactly what you said in a way. Sometimes there is an issue with the presentation of it, because I just assumed that it was more about the presentations, more about the reveals. That's the thing I would look forward to. I'd wake up the next day, go on Twitter, see what was announced, like look for those big games. And I think it's kind of like strangely marketed as like it's marketed as both, you know, it wants to be the Oscars of video games, but it also wants to be E3. And I think in a year where E3 has lost more relevance than ever, and we've had fewer of these award ceremonies, like people are looking towards the Game Awards even more so to be this hub of announcements, this hub of reveals and stuff. And I think, you know, it's got the length surely to be both. It's just, it's such a strange show. And I don't mean that like negatively. It's just like no other industry meshes these things together in this way, which makes it unique and weird, but also kind of like this weird experimental thing. So I don't know, to be honest. I think there's a lot of people who view it just as this announcement's hope, but then there are people, obviously, you know, who look forward to the speeches, who look forward to the categories, who look forward to seeing these creatives get their, you know, due.
Yeah, man. Well, if you, any side chat, any live chat, when, as it's rolling out on YouTube or anyone's channel or whatever, will tell you there's people just typing out the word boring or F over and over again until they get whatever reveal they're waiting for. And if that doesn't come, then they're all disappointed. But like the thing that stands out to me in regards to the way that he tries to differentiate awards from the reveals is that you'll come back after an ad break or you'll come back after a teaser and he'll just say, hey, by the way, this category was decided underneath, like to the side. And hey, this person won this and congratulations to them. Okay, next up, we've got a reveal from this. And I'm just like, that's the exact pivot point where you're tipping in the favor of the reveals and you're tipping in the favor of the easier access to, you know, people's eyeballs on this thing, which is valid. I think, like you said, the fact that no other industry does it this way is what makes it really valuable. Like I probably would, maybe one of the ways, for example, to pivot into the Oscars, maybe one of the ways that they get people more revitalized is you save your big film reveals for the Oscars, or you save the big talking points for that. I know it's a different medium, obviously, but you know, Oscars reported their lowest viewer numbers ever or something for the last, I mean, I didn't even know the ceremony had happened until after it was done, but stuff like that. And I wonder, is that like a way to approach a hybridized award ceremony, is that you do have a healthy amount of announcements alongside, but you can't, for me, you shouldn't take away from those teams' day in the sun. Like they get nominated, they get their emails, they have the likes of us requesting codes, we can make sure we're caught up and playing the latest games and everything. And then on the night, they get a banner along the bottom of the screen saying, hey, by the way, someone else won, or hey, by the way, you won, your award's in the post, and that's it. Like, I think there's a better way to pay off that side of it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's tricky. I'm definitely not saying the Oscars are an aspirational thing because, you know, no. I watched that show and I'm incredibly bored for most of it. You know, it's not fun. It's
but
very
if they had a Spider-Man trailer in there,
I'm not even going to say that. But what I will say about the Oscars is that, you know, even if a lot of people kind of like dismiss it every year and stuff, it still holds a level of, you know, cultural weight. If something gets announced for those categories, if something wins those categories, you know, it changes how those films are viewed. And I do want to get to a place where we have the Game Awards or whatever occupy that same space of prestige where games can go there and get recognized, both big games like God of War and smaller games like Sable, you know, in winning means something. Winning is valued as something. It's not just valued as 5 minutes before we get to the next big reveal or whatever. You know, the Oscars even has its own problem with winners be announced during ad breaks or not being shown in the live broadcast and stuff. So, you know, even if they took the ads out of the Game Awards, that would probably still happen. But yeah, I do think they need to just kind of decide what it wants to be, because it's just trying to be everything at the moment, and that's cool and that's noble. But I wonder whether we get to a point where these things are quite oppositional, maybe even exclusive, to have this big hype marketing machine alongside this supposedly sincere, you know, just celebration of games in general.
Well, that's the I was gonna say innocence, but the reality of that is also a massive hook for me. Like, I want to know what every, like, a body of critics or a body of whatever judges they've got think is the game of the year, just as a question, as a statement, as a talking point. I want to know what that is, and that is divorced from a marketing team doing their best to hype up the next release. I think that those things are just, they're just so diametrically opposed. I think they can both exist together, because it's just cool seeing some reveals while you're also being served up some awards, and people are taking away awards and doing victory speeches and whatever. But I think it needs to get the balance right, and I think that it is a valid sort of talking point that increasingly emerges over the years, because it's not like Jeff Keighley hasn't given into this stuff before. Not that the Dorito Pope stuff should haunt him for the rest of his days, but he has done this stuff before. And I'm sure it was at the Game Awards in 2014 or 15. I might be going too far back, but he had that big Mr. Gillette man who was just walking around as a big razor, and he just had like a big big razor head walking around.
That's ringing some bells.
Yeah, David Lynch nowhere in sight, but he was walking around, and that was the thing, because they kept stopping to be like, oh, let's get a word from such and such, and it would like cut to him, and he would interview someone, this giant razor head man, talking about sponsors, and it's like there again, you've pivoted the wrong way. You've gone too far down the sponsorship route, and I get that it greases the old palms, but you need to get the balance right. We should end the Game Awards conversation, though, by saying or asking, what is your game of the year from the six that are in here? What do you think is actually going to win? It's between Deathloop, It Takes Two, Metroid Dread, Psychonauts 2, Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart, and Resident Evil Village. What do you think is actually
going to win? Man, like, what do I think is going to win, or what is my...
Well, both, I guess. So. What do you think the body of critics will have voted for? We'll also clarify that I mentioned Jeff in the old DMs before. We voted last year, and we are still on the jury panel as of the Video Game Awards website, but we ain't judging this year. Big, big Jeff didn't get in touch at all. So maybe we can just do it now.
Hey.
We can just do it now.
I think Metroid Dread might win, because it's such... Mm. I think it's like, we've got two critical darlings here, don't we? We've got Deathloop and we've got Metroid Dread.
I would say three. I would say It Takes Two is very high.
Right. Ooh,
like, critically, okay. that thing reviewed very, very well. Yeah.
That is true. I don't know. For me, I sort of view it as like a La La Land Moonlight sort of thing, where Deathloop almost seems like the La La Land, and we've got Metroid Dread as the Moonlight. And whilst this big thing was in front, I feel like that's almost become so obvious that people will go, you know what, Metroid Dread, that's the one. That's the thing that
I would
wins.
Not have said Deathloop is the La La Land. To me, Resident Evil Village is the La La Land. Like, the go-to, ooh, everyone's seen it, everyone loves it, everyone has opinions on it. Resident Evil is the most widespread of these, I would say, especially compared to Psychonauts 2. It Takes Two, you fundamentally need someone else in person to get through it. I guess you can play it online, but you need someone else to play through it. Deathloop, for me, is the Moonlight. It's the critically revered... Because, you know, Deathloop's not as widely played as a Resident Evil, like, at all.
No, well, no, but I wouldn't even have Resident Evil in there necessarily. For me, no, Resident Evil is like the Mad Max Fury Road of the nominations, where it's like, that's the one people love, that's what people want to win, but it's not like the critical darling, the front runner in the same way that the other two were. It's not getting 10 out of 10s across the board like, you know, Deathloop did. That's what I mean. I don't mean in terms of like popularity or mainstream reach. I mean in terms of like Just the sheer amount of praise and the amount of, like, you know, articles I've been reading.
When I think about that comparison for that year, when it was La La Land and Moonlight, it's like La La Land is the thing that everyone's seen. Moonlight is the thing you need to get round to, that your mate who loves films keeps telling you to watch, and you'll get there eventually because it's on the Oscar list. But I think in regards to this, it might be, I hope it's Metroid Dread. For me, that's the most solid of all of them. But I also think that it could actually go to It Takes Two. I feel like Joseph Fares is on a really phenomenal upswing right now. I feel like he's kind of just gone from strength to strength. And as much as, like I said, It Takes Two wouldn't be my number one, you almost can't find a fault with that game. Like, if you were literally going to hold it up and go, okay, what does it strive for? What does it actually not hit? It absolutely smashes everything. Like, it's ridiculously proficient from that team and from EA Publishing, and to have so much of an individual creator coming through in that game as well.
No, I totally agree. I wouldn't be annoyed at any of those three winning it. I would like to see Resident Evil Village win it, but I don't think it's going to. stuff like Ratchet and Clank, for me, it's a good game, but it's not strong enough to be in that nomination list when others perhaps deserve it more. So for me, yeah, if it's It Takes Two, if it's Deathloop, if it's Metroid Dread, any of those, I'd be like, I can see why we've got here. I think you deserve it. Well,
are there any all around don't want to win, which I threw in as an addendum question for the sheer lols of it, because I don't want Deathloop to win. That's my side.
It's harsh. I feel like I'm being harsh on a really good 4-star game, but it's Ratchet and Clank just because that would make me feel out of the loop. Like, if that won, I wouldn't understand it, because I'd be like, there's something wrong with me then. I'd be like, what did I miss from that game that everyone loves so much?
I adore Ratchet and Clank. I think that is the It Takes Two thing. It's like, hold Ratchet and Clank up. What does it not hit? Like, you can say, like, okay, it didn't do anything that much new, but I would say, well, the loading techniques, the way that they do, like, design the levels around the SSD is really, really cool. But, like, yeah, that might be the one that's too safe a bet, potentially.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I mean, I think, especially compared to the other things which take more risks, even if they don't necessarily pay off in as polished ways. You know, you've got Deathloop's entire gimmick. You've got the writing side of it. You've got It Takes Two with the entire structure of that game and how many different genres it packs in. And then you've got Metroid Dread being this kind of, like, you know, throwback, but not, you know, pristine.
And modernizing 2.5. Everything.
Yeah, modernizing an older kind of series, I suppose. So for me, they have an added edge that Ratchet and Clank doesn't, because again, Ratchet and Clank is really good, but I can't get beyond really good. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, just when we're talking in terms of final awards.
Well, I think that would be my thing for Resident Evil. Like, I played Village and it was tight, but I was like, I mean, we've talked about this so much, but, like, yeah, there's parts of it that disappointed me. There's parts of it where I wish there was more to it. I wish Lady Dimitrescu was in that more than the opening 20 minutes and stuff like that. But yeah, I like the fact that we don't have a clear-cut winner. I like the fact that we don't know who's actually going to win. That always makes it more interesting on the night. And by the time, actually, we'll be pre-recording next week's wind-up, which will go up after the Game Awards. So we might not even weigh in on the Game Awards, because I think you might be away to visit Mr. Chris Kringle by then.
I don't want to jinx it. It depends how much work I have to do on Monday, but I'm in on Monday, so we might be able to get one more live one before the pre-records come out. So maybe I'll make a half promise right now.
Good. We will see how we go. But yes, thanks everybody for listening. I've been Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Always a pleasure. This has been a pleasure. Pleasure Beach. This has been a wind-up, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.